Blog Talk Radio.
Meow.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and ghouls, step right up. Behind this curtain lies a ghastly concoction of delight, horror, fantasy, and terror. Your every wish is our command. Your every whimsical desire brought to life. But I'm warning you, there's always a price. Welcome to the greatest show on earth!
And welcome back to the greatest show on earth that is Talking Terror. As always, I'm your old pal, the King of Horror, Andy G. Welcome you back to this episode of the show, where tonight we're going to be talking about the Demonic Beings film pick of the week from 1975, Wolf Guy, directed by Kazuhiko Yamaguchi. Stars Sonny Chiba and may or may not definitely have werewolves. But we'll be talking about that a little later on in the show when the Dean joins us for his film pick of the week. But I'm joined by the bold and the beautiful, the Gold Geek Keith.
Not yet. I'm going to scare them.
Oh, see, that's right, folks. If you're just joining us, the Ghoul Gal and Sammy went out for ice cream. So the ghoul is currently standing behind a tree, and he is waiting to scare them when they get home. Who knows when they're going to get home? I certainly don't, because they went out to a Quick Check, which is kind of like a gas station where you pick up ice cream. But knowing them, they'll take a long time. And he'll be standing out there for the entire show, waiting for them to come back. So that's fun. So,
hello!
We're going to be talking about that.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Talking Terror.
God. It was a success, as you could tell. Scared the shit out of the
blue cat.
That blood-curdling scream that you heard was none other than the little monster himself. Oh, my God. You got to, okay, I got to go back outside because the dog's barking and kids stomping and they're slamming doors.
Mm-hmm.
God, they're animals here. They're animals like they're fucking wolf people or something.
Like wolf guys?
Like wolf guys, except they're like wolf and woman.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they're definitely wolves. And in no way, just Sonny Chiba karate chopping his way across Tokyo, or wherever he's from. I don't know if they ever
karate
that, but we'll figure it out what we want to do. Karate wolf chop. But, of course, we are joined by the demonic Dean himself, who's presenting his film pick of the week tonight. Welcome back, Dean.
Yes, I'm so excited to be here to present my film pick of the week this week. I heard you just talking about karate chops and Sonny Chiba, and there will be plenty more Sonny Chiba to talk about this evening as our show unfolds.
Chiba-san.
Yeah, it's certainly a lot to talk about with that movie.
Yamaha.
Later on in the show.
Mitsubishi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Toyota. I know
Hatsio.
Japanese.
Sony.
PlayStation. We know
Sony.
On this show.
I ride the big fucking
Pokemon. That's a big thing, right?
Oh,
Pokemon. Yeah.
Oh, Pokemon. Oh,
Pocket
yeah.
Monsters.
Okay,
yeah,
what's
yeah,
up?
I know.
Arigato, Mr. Roboto.
You guys, but you said... Since you said Pokemon, have either of you seen that funny reel going around where the girl was like, he came here and he was trying to play Pokemon but didn't know what he was talking about, and then it shows like the guy and he's like given the all of the actual Pokemon characters like real like different names. It was really funny. I don't know if you guys have seen it. Just when you said Pokemon, it made me think of it.
No, I'll have to see if I can find that reel. I don't know. My girlfriend plays fucking Pokemon Go. Like, it's her job. So I'm kind of learning about Pokemon a little bit. I'm never going to play it. It's too much for me. But she plays it a lot, and she's having fun with it. So, you know, I've never seen somebody so intently throw fucking colored balls at monsters and go, God damn it, I missed it. God! And I was like, oh, sorry. I'll go away.
See, I'm currently... playing this Microsoft, well, I don't know what company it is, but there's a company out there that kind of like is in the middle of a bit of a lawsuit, and the game is available on the Microsoft Xbox as well as the computer system. It's called Pal World. See, not Pokemon.
I've heard of that.
Pals. They're pals.
Mm-hmm.
So unlike Pokemon, in which you have, like, you know, like strategic battles with creatures and shit like that, in this game, you beat the creature into submission, then you jam it in the ball. And then once you have the creature in the ball, just like Pokemon, you can use said creature to battle other creatures to capture them as well. But unlike Pokemon, in this game, you can craft weaponry like machine guns and other high-end artillery and equip said monsters with those weapons. Or you can even, you know, you can also make things to equip said monster as your own weapon. So you can shove your fist up like a penguin's ass and then, like, fire off, like, ice grenades out of its mouth and shit like that.
That's fucking interesting. Yeah. That's something. I mean, I know the monkey was telling me about that the other day. And I was like, oh, cool. So it's kind of like a Pokemon knockoff. He's like, yep. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, it's fun.
Oh, they,
you know, at least we're learning.
They
in
look
playing.
Just like them. They look just like them. I mean, you know, I'm not sure how old. I mean, I felt the same way about shit like Yu-Gi-Oh! And stuff like that as well. So I don't know how the laws are going to work against them or with them or whatnot. But, like, I mean, you know, I mean, these fucking things, unlike Yu-Gi-Oh!, these things look like Pokemon. So I'm not sure exactly how the world of monsters works. I would assume you can create whatever kind of monster you want and have it look any way, as long as it's not a direct ripoff of said property of other company.
I guess so. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, they got away with it somehow. You know, I don't know anything about that world. I just know if there's one Pokemon called Psyduck that I fucking relate to so much, and I was like, that's my guy. Because he's just fucking constantly fucking anxiety little and just panicking.
Mm-hmm.
Just has his hands on
his
fucking
like psychic explosion.
Yeah, that's exactly what he does. He's just constantly filled with anxiety and dread. And I was like, yeah, I get that. I'm with Psyduck.
He's just bricked up.
Yeah. I was like, I love that little guy, you know, but yeah, so
being a rimmer, you know what I mean, everybody needs a rim job every now and again, and that'll take care of that kind of problem.
I mean, that's just the greatest way to wake up in the morning. Definitely a good rim job. Start the day.
A little flick of the tongue on the old bunghole.
Mm-hmm. And you just straight up just fucking dig around there. You know, have some fun, explore. You know, if you have a partner in the room. You know. Sometimes a little flick up the butthole just helps you wake up a little bit. I do. I enjoy it. I don't mind it. You know, hey.
But see, well, here's the question, though. Are you the rimmer or the rimmy?
Oh, I'm the rimmer completely, man.
Okay. How about you?
Because I'm just a hungry boy.
What's that?
How about you? Are you the rimmer or the rimmy?
I'm an equal opportunity employer.
Oh, look at you.
Fair enough.
Fair play.
Go both ends on that, huh? You know, I'm definitely more of the rimmer end of that. I feel like, you know, the problem is when done wrong, it just feels like you got, like, diarrhea in your butt cheeks. And it can't be too sloppy. It's got to be, like, playful and not too wet.
It does. And that's why I like being the rimmer rather than the rim E, because I can control it. I can have some fun, you know. And then, you know, I like eating in general because I'm a big guy. I like to eat. So I have no complaints. So I'm going to go with that.
He is indeed a big guy.
I am, and I'm a hungry boy, you know, so I do like to eat, you know.
I like to dungeon dive. You know, I mean, push that tongue in a little firm and just, yep.
There's nothing wrong with playing a little bit of Tetris down there, you know, just kind of rearranging things a little bit, you know, using it like a little boxing thing. You know, it's fun. You know, I mean, speaking of boxing, we have Jake Paul versus Mike Tyson coming up soon. Thanks to the Dean letting us know about that. That's going to be exciting.
Boy, Faye. Yeah. I love Tyson. I do. And he is somebody that, you know, even regardless of all the stupid hijinks and even whatever lawful issues that he's had over the years, you know, there's just something about that man that I just love him. I do, with all my heart.
I love
professional boxing. He's Mike Tyson. He's been the source of so many enjoyable and entertaining moments throughout, like from my childhood to today even. What I hope to see in that is a 57-year-old man who was a professionally trained and powerhouse of a fighter who I have seen, you know, even in his advanced age, you know, sparring around and throwing punches at bags and seeing that he can really fucking hit hard. What I'd like to see is him put this brash, young, gum-flapping YouTuber down quick and early. I don't believe that's what's going to happen. I mean, this is kind of, you know, these things are like WWE with this kid.
Mm-hmm.
He tends to pick and choose who his opponents are. The matches are more about entertainment than anything else.
Yeah, they're exhibitions, man. This is not real boxing in like the ranked boxing classes. This is a fucking sideshow.
No. But what I will give, you know, as far as credit, now whether it's steroids or whatever, you know, the kid did bulk himself up and put in some semblance of work to actually put himself into like physical fit, like, you know, to be physically fit to actually fight in a, whatever you want to call it, you know. I've also seen him throw punches. They're wild, but they do look like he could hit hard. But that's where I think somebody like Tyson, you know, would potentially be able to take him down fairly easy. You know, I know he lost to Tommy Fury, which was a split decision. And Tommy Fury, you know, the younger brother of Tyson Fury, who is less known for his boxing prowess and more known for his time on Love Island and other reality TV shows, he's a pretty face. He is. He's a professional fighter. Don't get me wrong. You know, he's a pro fighter, you know, and, you know, the kid can fight. But, you know, I think as far as those two went, it was more about, hey, let's put on a show. Let's make this stretch out. Let's make millions of dollars. And I'm sure Tyson, you know, is looking at it in a similar fashion. He wants to make the money. But what I really hope is that he's kind of like playing possum, you know, and I'm hoping that it's going to be like, oh yeah, you know, like, sure, we're gonna put on a good show. Don't worry, Jake. Don't worry, I'm gonna take care of you. And then the fight's gonna start, and Tyson is gonna be like Mike Tyson, and he's gonna knock this kid the fuck out, and then he's gonna get in front of that camera and be like, "This is what you get for being a mockery of my sport, okay? Because this is what I do for a living. This is what my lifeblood has been about." And there's no way that I was going to let this little punk ass do this to me. So that's what I'm hoping to see.
Yeah, even that's kind of like subdued for a Mike Tyson fucking interview.
No.
Like, I feel like he's going to say a whole lot more. But I'm going to eat his dick.
I'm going to go
and
I'm
going to
rape his girlfriend next, and then I'm going to fuck his mom because I'm probably his dad, and I'm going to eat his brother's asshole too. Like, I mean, you know, do I want to see all of that? Fucking A, I do. But, you know, I was trying to keep it cool.
Yeah, I know. I kind of expect more from Mike Tyson when he cuts fucking promos because he knows how to do it. Yeah, it's all a charade. Like, I mean, even fucking Logan Paul in WWE, he's a fucking U.S. champion. Such a fucking joke for him to be the champion of that fucking title. There's so many other people that I'd rather see holding it. But, you know, let's fucking Logan Paul hold it.
Listen, I say, look, whatever you want to say about Jake, you know, is it a quote-unquote real sport? But we always make fun and knock of these celebrities that want to pop into wrestling, you know, or professional wrestling for these periods of time. And they coast by, they have like a match, two, four, whatever amount. They give them a title, you know, David Arquette, I'm talking to you.
David Arquette, WCW World Heavyweight Champion.
You know, fucking guy was a world heavyweight champion, you know, along with the likes of Dusty Rhodes and fucking Ric Flair. That man held that fucking belt. That's a mockery. I don't care what kind of super fan he is or not. But what I will give Logan Paul is this. He also has put in the work. You can see it in the matches. He likes to put on a show. He's willing to take a good bump or two. You know, they've obviously had him working with people that make other people look really good. But he has helped that along. So I'm really not as – against him kind of getting any kind of little something. At least it's not the major championship. You know what I mean? He ain't fighting Seth Rollins. He ain't winning the Money in the Bank briefcase. Like, this will be what he does for a little bit. And who knows? Dude, I swear, if we're talking about Logan Paul still in the fucking WWE 10 years from now, I'll be like, get the fuck out of here. Look at this. That would be like The Miz all over again, you know?
Yeah,
Nobody beats
The Miz turns it around. Nobody beats The Miz or The Wiz. But, yeah, I don't see Logan Paul being talked about in 10 years in WWE. Or fucking, you know, they want to do it right. Fucking Damian Priest still has the Money in the Bank briefcase. Fucking cash in against Logan Paul. That's how you fucking do it at Mania.
Because
he can do it against any fucking title.
Damian Priest at this point is going to go down as the first guy to ever have the Money in the Bank briefcase and not cash it in. And he's going to lose it. Because I think it expires after a period of time. It's a one-year contract, I thought.
It does, because Money in the Bank's coming up. The next pay-per-view in 2024 is coming up, and he still fucking has it. So no way he's having it after Mania. Like, he's either going to cash it and lose it, or he's going to succeed and win one of the titles, whatever he wants to do. But, yeah, he has to drop it, because we're coming up on Money in the Bank. So he's held on to it fucking long enough. Time for it to go. What a waste, you know, but, you know, they make decisions, and they think it's right at the time, and it's not, but.
Yeah, but it's weird. I mean, we said that about him when he won that to begin with. It was like, well, what the fuck is he going to do with it? He was definitely not title, you know what I mean, not major title fucking worthy. And then, like you would say, they started bandying about how, like, oh, well, you know, the Money in the Bank briefcase could be used for any title in the WWE. But then that kind of really, like, lessens the whole idea of the Money in the Bank. You know, like, if fuckers are in there fighting and clawing and killing each other to get that briefcase just so that they can fucking bust in and go for the Intercontinental title, like, you know, the U.S. title, oh, shit, why you go for fucking, you know, the 24-7 while you're at it? You know, like, it's just, it's silly. You know, it needs to be for the major title. That's the only way to cash it in. It should be a contract for a major title. And I'm sorry, but, you know, if you want to give it to somebody and you want to give it to somebody that's kind of unproven, then you better be giving it to somebody that you feel capable of actually holding that title. You know, a Kofi Kingston, who, you know, again, we all thought that push was a little weird, but it happened. He got it.
I mean,
he held it for a little while.
That was a huge upset when he won. I was kind of surprised that they gave it to him and he actually held on to it for a little while. You know, I thought that Big E would get it before he did, but no. You know, Kofi hung on to it and he had his moment. But again, that was that weird time when they just kind of wanted to capitalize again on the Daniel Bryan movement, like the Yes movement, where they're like, yeah, the fucking underdog, the little guy, he can fucking do it. You know, he's not here anymore, so we got Kofi. Like, you know, just like they're doing now with Cody Rhodes.
I forgot if it was Fastlane or Elimination Chamber, whatever it was. It was the pay-per-view before Mania. Might have been Elimination Chamber. Yeah, it was, actually, where Kofi put on a fucking phenomenal show. Mm-hmm. And he was in that Elimination Chamber match. And I remember saying, while watching that match, like, wow, if they give Kofi this title in this Elimination Chamber match, I have zero problem with it because of the fucking match that he's putting on right now. Like, he was doing amazing things. Then they didn't give it to him, and it was like, oh, okay. And then the next 2 months became all about, like, oh, we're going to push Kofi to be the main event guy at WrestleMania. And it was like, it kind of made sense when he had five other guys that were all kind of beating up and weakening the other guys around him. But now when you're making this a one-on-one, not so much. And I feel like that lessened the impact of him winning that title. Had they given it to him at Elimination Chamber, I think he would have been held in regard a much more solid champ than what he ended up doing.
I completely agree. I mean, he did have a decent run. I was surprised they let him hold it for as long as they did, because I figured it would be kind of like a flip champion, where he wins it, and then, you know, a month or two later, he's gone. But no, he held it for a little while.
Well, that's
really
because they couldn't take it away from him too soon, or else it would have been viewed as racist, because, you know, they turned that into being like him being the first black fucking champion, and it's like, oh, okay, you know, let's not think about The Rock or, you know, other people of partial
or
color.
Mark Henry.
Like, Booker T.
Booker T. You know, the list goes on.
Yeah, like, I know they didn't hold that, like, literal championship, but that's because, you know, the WWE has only gone through, you know, X amount of titles in the last 20 years where they make them, they turn them, they change them, they combine them, then they fucking separate them, then they put them back together again. And it's like, okay, but, like, again, the way they made it sound was like Kofi Kingston is like the first black champion ever for the WWE. And, no, not really.
No,
I don't think it works that
because,
way.
Because, yeah. Yeah, because I keep thinking about Mark Henry, and he was in 2011. So that, it's not like it was that long ago, 2011. And that was only a short term. That was only like 4 or 5 months, but he still fucking held it. But they're like, Kofi, first
was
black
that, was that, though, was that the ECW championship?
No, it was the heavyweight championship.
It was the heavyweight, okay. I just remember, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
what
I remember he held it at
Mark
the
tail Henry. That's what I do.
The Hall of
I
Fame.
Eat people.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, I'm looking it up now. Yeah, September 2011 to December 2011, Henry held the World Heavyweight title in WWE. Which is his first and only world title reign with promotion. So, you know, but then again, he was getting that fucking huge push. You know, that's what I do. I hurt people. It's a whole thing.
You guys hijacked the conversation.
I apologize. We have. And I'm looking at the time, and I want to talk about Wolf Guy. But I also want to talk about some news, because there is some stuff to talk about. So let's go, Dean. What are you talking about with horror news?
Boop-a-da-boop-a-da-boop-a-da-boop-a-da-boop.
We have talked here on this program about some of the not necessarily genre-related films that have been killed in like tax-saving moves by studios such as the Batgirl movie and lately, most recently, the Roadrunner versus Acme kind of live-action / animated feature with John Cena was one of them. And we have talked about how the most recent adaptation of Stephen King's Salem's Lot has been in the can, but pulled from all release schedules with no word on whether this thing was going to see the light of day. And the general consensus seemed to be this is going to be another one that is killed for financial purposes or tax write-offs or whatever the business side of these decisions is. But that is not the case. It has been announced that Salem's Lot is going to hit the HBO streaming service Max later this year. There is no release date of when that's going to happen, but Warner Brothers and HBO have announced that this will be debuting on Max later this year. So if people have been looking forward to Salem's Lot and wondering why they haven't had the chance to see it yet, they will now have the chance to see it in this, the year 2024.
Of our
wow,
Lord.
Finally happening. Yeah, Year of Our Lord, 2024. J. Christ. All right, that's happening. All right, so what else
Jay
are we talking
Crizzy.
About? J. Crizzle.
Yes. Also, in the realm, Stephen King, Stephen Graham Jones has had this horror novel trilogy going on. The first book was called My Heart is a Chainsaw. Second book was For All the Pussies. It was called Don't Fear the Reaper. And
sucked.
The third...
Pussy song.
And, well, pussy
book. It is.
The third and final book in this trilogy is coming out on March 26th with the title The Angel of the Indian Lake. This audiobook will have a full cast, including a previous participant named Isabella Starr LeBlanc, but this time out will also feature horror veteran and mainstay Barbara Crampton, as well as narration from none other than Stephen King himself. So once again, that is the final trilogy, final entry in this horror trilogy, The Angel of the Indian Lake, which comes on March 26th.
Yeah, I actually read My Heart is a Chainsaw. I know there's a struggle to get through. It was fun because the character Jay Daniels in the book is super into horror movies, and she's always quoting them and like what the best slasher movie is. And it was kind of a weird ending to that. And then the next book came out, and I still haven't finished it. Like, I got so bored within the first couple chapters. I was like, all right, I got to finish this one day. But Stephen Grant Jones is very dry when he writes. So you kind of got to get used to that type of writing, and I'm not really a fan of that. But, you know, if you like horror references in your books, I would say check them out. But me, it's just they're just fucking long and just very, very fucking dry. But hopefully the movies can kind of turn it around, because sometimes the movies can be better than the books. Not always, but sometimes. Yeah. But, all right, Dean, moving on from those.
I always
recommend
feel
them.
Like the book is better than the movie, so, but that's just me.
Yeah, well, you know, especially when it comes to Stephen King, usually the movies are better than the books, you know, I find. But Inception, Pet Sematary, I think that book is way better than the movie. But they still haven't made a proper adaptation of that. I would love a proper fucking adaptation of Pet Sematary, you know, but I don't think we're ever going to get it. Bloodlines didn't do it. You know, I saw that. I don't know if you guys checked it out, but you know, I'm looking for a proper one of that. but yeah, but Stephen King, oh, it's good. Yeah, this isn't good. But, you know, him doing narration, I guess he loves it. I know that he's a huge fan of Late Night with the Devil. Like, he talked highly of that trailer, and he saw the movie, and he was like, oh, it's, like, going to be one of the best ones. So, but then again, you never know how much he got paid for that. They could have easily given him a nice, sweet paycheck to be like, just say our movie's awesome. Okay. You take this to the bank, and yes, your movie is awesome.
I mean, I also look at it this way, right? Like, he's got to figure – people see the movie, whether they like it or not, they might end up going to check out the source material and therefore end up buying his book. So no matter, it's kind of a win-win for Stephen King no matter what. You know, he's getting paid to have his name attached to it. He's getting paid for the name recognition. He's Stephen fucking King, you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I absolutely have no problem with that. And I hope that Stephen King keeps writing and keeps making them fucking checks. You know, he's one of our favorites here on the show, so I have no problem with him profiting. I have no problem. Even though I kind of wish that he could write a third act. I only complain with Stephen King. Learn how to finish a story.
Somewhere along the line, he became really challenged by that. Wasn't always the case.
No, not always. You're right. You're right. Not always. But at a certain point, he just forgot how to make a third act work and kind of just kept dropping the ball. You know, and you're having a great time, and then you get to that third act, and it's like, okay, we're here. You know, I think the biggest disappointment for me was Under the Dome. That fucking book I loved, and then I got to the third act, and I'm like, oh,
dude.
What? All right,
dude.
He got bored. He didn't know what to do.
Yeah, no, man. I remember reading that book, and me and the dean were reading it at around the same time, and, you know, we
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember the both of us being like, really? Like, that's where that fucking goes, huh? Like, that was just fucking stupid.
Yep.
He didn't know what to do, and he panicked.
It really was.
It
was so good. Everything up to it was so good. Yeah.
You know, and
then the show took it to a whole other fucking level. So.
Oh, the show was
fucking
batshit.
I started to... Who was the star in that one again?
Britt Robertson.
Yeah, Britt Robertson, yeah. She was the main one that I remember. And then the other guy, I can't remember his name, he was in Grind and Texas Chainsaw Massacre at the beginning, blonde-haired guy, Eric Balfour. I can't remember his name. But yeah, he was the lead.
Yeah, I don't fully remember, but I remember it being terrible. Because I read them both around the same time, when I had a little bit of a King reading resurgence, that one and also the Kennedy one.
11/22/63,
and I felt the same way about the finale to that one.
Oh,
and that one they also turned into a series with James Franco that was fucking beyond terrible.
Oh really? I haven't seen it yet, so I'm glad I can pass that.
I almost feel like anything
pass on
with
that
James
one.
Franco is it's just apt for problems, because I just don't like him much as an actor. So.
Never liked him. Never could get into James Franco. But yeah. No, I mean, the fucking show, it lasted far too many seasons. It was only three seasons, but it lasted way too many seasons. And you know, at some point there was caves and, like, traveling from place to place, and, like, none of it made sense. It just, it was like the book was even, like, at least it had a fucking cohesive fucking weird ending. Under the Dome, it was just like, oh, all right, we're all of a sudden in California now. How the hell did that happen? I don't know. All right.
Yeah, so the weird. The 11/22/63 one, when that came out, probably mid 20 teens, maybe 2014 or 15, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a limited. It was 6 episodes or 8 episodes. It was like a limited series, and it starred James.
Yeah,
Franco.
Wasn't it on Netflix?
No, it was like Hulu. It was one of the first Hulu originals. Yeah, it was like
I knew it was on one of the streaming services.
Yeah, it was like I feel like it was one of Hulu's first steps into the original content market. But man, was it fucking shitty, in my opinion. I liked so much of the book. Aside from the end, that I was kind of looking forward to the series, and then it was we were flying from California back to New Jersey for something, and like the first 2 episodes, maybe the first 3 episodes, were like available to watch on the plane, and I was like, oh shit, like sweet, and I put it on, and like I don't even know that I definitely watched the first episode and was like, I don't know, and like probably carried on to the second one. I don't even know if I finished the second episode. I mean, it was really bad.
Mm-hmm. That's usually how it goes, you know. That one was kind of the same way, especially when you see like the casting, you know, of who they cast for the characters. You're like, that's not how it worked. That's not how I imagined that character in my head, and it's just like it's the complete opposite, and it sucks. Especially the guy from Breaking Bad playing Big Jim Rennie. Dean Norris, I'm like, that's not Big Jim Rennie to me. That's like, you know, you need like a John Goodman in the 90s type of guy to play
he
Big
totally
Jim Rennie.
Had, you know what? I don't know if you remember the show Friday Night Lights, but the guy that played Buddy Garrity.
Buddy Garrity, man.
Friday Night Lights.
He would have been good, yep.
100% fucking perfect for that.
I actually specifically 100%, and the actor's name was Brad Leland, but I specifically remember that the ghoul and I were reading it at roughly the same time, and I don't remember the character's name. What was the character's name in the book? You just said it. What was the name?
Big Jim Rennie.
All right. I remember specifically when the ghoul and I were texting about it, and I was like, I'm not saying anything, but think about that character and tell me who that character reminds you of. And like, ghoul didn't miss a beat. Was like, fucking Buddy Garrity, and like that's exactly who I was thinking of. I remember that conversation.
We were both balls deep in Friday Night Lights at that time too.
Right,
dude. I remember the day we watched the finale, and the two of us, both on the fucking phone, we're both crying.
Oh,
I hear Nicole in the background going, it's fucking men's soap opera. What the fuck is wrong with you two?
Lifetime for men. Lifetime for men.
Oh,
I don't
shit.
Even really like, I don't even fucking really like football, man. That much.
Oh, I fucking love that show, though, man. That is for sure.
I know.
I've only seen a couple episodes, you know, that were on NBC, because I remember the movie was pretty good, but I don't remember a couple episodes from the TV series. But all right, Dean, moving on from that, what else are we talking about?
Production House, The Asylum, they produced the horror TV series Z Nation for 5 mm-hmm. seasons and 68 episodes on Sci-Fi back in from 2014 to 2018. And then were behind, I never have watched any of Z Nation, but then they were behind what was a prequel series, and I talked about this recently on the show, on Netflix mm-hmm. for 2 seasons in 2019 and 2021, Black Summer.
Yeah.
Now, as I have previously stated, I thoroughly enjoyed Black Summer and was very disappointed when I learned recently, just recently, that Netflix had ghost canceled it. Like, it's been canceled, but there was no, like, announcement. Like, Netflix is often like, here are the 17 shows that we're not renewing. You know, it was never formally publicly announced, but the creators behind it said that that they've been canceled. Anyway, that's a bummer because the second season ended on a massive cliffhanger. But Asylum has posted on their Instagram account that Z Nation is coming back, and to expect a big announcement about Z Nation soon.
All right, very cool. Sure, it has its fans excited about that. So we'll see what happens with new news about Z Nation.
Yeah, this is a bummer about Black Summer, man. That show is really fucking good. So every year when contractors that work at the South Pole arrive and unload, the day comes where the transport and supply plane departs, and the people that are working at the South Pole are cut off, you know, until November. And it's an annual tradition that the day after the supply plane leaves, that all of the contractors that are working at the South Pole get together and they watch John Carpenter's The Thing. And
I thought this was like a Santa Claus story at first, and then I realized you were saying the South Pole.
The South Pole. And this recent screening of The Thing had a big surprise in that John Carpenter himself surprised the South Pole crew by joining the watch party via Zoom and spoke with the contractors and hung out on Zoom and answered questions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. With John Carpenter joining the South Pole, The Thing watch party.
Oh, that's awesome. Very cool. All right. What's next?
Smile 2. We know it had been announced and that there was a target release date of October 18th of this year, October 18th, 2024. The thoughts were that production would be going into production at any time, but what was not known is that it's already been in production, that the director, Parker Finn, back in December, had assembled the cast, and actor Luke Gage has said that he has already finished all of his work on the sequel. So the Smile sequel already deep into production, which bodes well for hitting its October 18th target release date this year.
Indeed.
I enjoyed it, the first Smile, so looking forward to seeing what happens in part two. All right, what are we talking about next?
Levin herself, Millie Bobby Brown, says that she is excited for fans to see the final season of Stranger Things. She says there's not much that she can tease, but she says you just have to trust the Duffers that they are geniuses, and that from what she has read thus far, it's going to be unbelievable. The final season of Stranger Things is anticipated to be filming all this year, and there is no expectation of seeing the fifth and final season until sometime in 2025. And although we've talked about this before, just a reminder that for the upcoming fifth and final season, Sarah Connor herself, Mrs. Hamilton, Linda Hamilton, has joined the cast for the fifth season of Stranger Things.
Yeah,
Connor.
Yes. Scream 2, baby. Love that fucking movie. All right, Dean. Moving on from Stranger Things. 5, what else are we talking about?
Another horror writer, Grady Hendrix, who has had a lot of his works turned into shows and films and whatnot, including
the girl's actually reading his stuff now. Actually, she's
pretty good.
One of his books.
Yes, his novel, My Best Friend's Exorcism, was turned into a feature film through Amazon Prime. There is going to be a film of his How to Sell a Haunted House in the works. And it's been announced that his short horror story that was part of a short horror collection called Ankle Snatcher is going to be getting a TV adaptation coming up in the near future as well. So, you know, one of the newer voices that is writing in the realm of horror has been pumping out his works into TV and film. So I know I'm pretty sure on the program before we have talked about how to sell a haunted house in being in the works, but now his mm-hmm. Ankle Snatcher short story also getting a feature adaptation.
Yeah, I'm surprised about that. Yeah, because the Final Girl support group that he also wrote hasn't gotten any kind of an adaptation. Kind of surprised. That was a good one. You know, they went right to How to Sell a Haunted House. But yeah, Grady Hendrix is pretty good. Hopefully the Ghoul Gal likes his stuff. I mean, I enjoy it. You know, he's got a good voice.
She really liked the one. It was something about was it a vampire thing? Something about a vampire. I forget the exact title of it.
Oh, the Southern Book Club for Vampires.
Yes. She found it to be a good mix of like comedy and some decent horror in there as well. You know, she was tickled enough to where she wants to read more of his stuff. So, I mean, that for her typically is just is a good sign of her enjoying the author, because, you know, certain authors she just doesn't gel with, and she will totally drop with like no problem. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she might like My Best Friend's Exorcism. That was kind of fun, set in the 80s, kind of like the Exorcist type thing. Or the Final Girl support group
that.
Is good.
I mm-hmm. have that. I bought that book originally because it looked like an old VHS clamshell.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, what a cool, like, looking book. So, like, I actually never read
yeah.
it. I've just owned it. I got to dig it out. It's, like, buried somewhere. But, yeah, I figure that's what she'll probably read next.
It's pretty decent, and each of the chapters are 80 song titles that were popular. It pops off, so
very cool.
Kind of cool to see what they picked. So, and you have the paperback, which I wanted, but I ended up getting the hardcover when it first came out, which is basically like a yearbook photo, but one girl has her back to the camera, and that's the possessed
girl.
And I was like, oh, it's kind of fun, but then I saw the VHS one. I was like, fuck, I should have waited for the paperback. Paperback is much cooler, but I know I had to get the hardcover when it came out. But yeah, he's worth a read. And then there's the book that he did called Horror Store, which is basically about a haunted IKEA. That's really fun, but it's more of a visual fun book than it is like a fiction read. But, you know, if you're looking for something different, Horror Store is pretty good. That was his first one. And then, of course, Paperbacks from Hell, which is all about paperbacks from the 80s, all the horror ones. I have that too. I started collecting paperback horror, so that was a good research, but... Yeah, very cool with Grady Hendrix. I hope that, you know, he keeps making more good stuff. But, all right, Dean, what else are we talking about?
Well, Dean, if I can, because I know the kids
mm-hmm.
are not watching it at all, and I know you have been. Are you all caught up on the current Walking Dead?
I have the third one to watch, which I'll be watching after the show tonight. So if you've watched
it, that means
it's taken about 4 to 5 years, but you have finally... outpaced me. In all fairness, you haven't finished Dead City, and we both haven't watched Daryl Dixon. But as far as the main storyline, you're an episode ahead.
How do you know that? How do you know I didn't finish?
That's right. He could have.
Okay, let me rephrase. From our last episode of Talking Terror, you had not yet watched Dead City or Daryl Dixon. All of Dead
City. I've not finished Dead City yet.
Okay, so.
Oh, you ruined it. You should have said you did.
My statistics remain the same,
but
it's fine.
Yeah.
I'll be all caught up. Last night, I was watching. I've said before, in the episodes of 2024 that I've participated in so far, but I've decided that 2024 is the year of me truly making the effort to catch up and watch shows, and maybe later in the year I'll switch to films, but to watch shows that I have known of that have sounded like shows that I've really loved and then never watched in the time that they were on, and making the effort to watch these shows when I have my solo nighttime time, and truly make an effort to watch versus just endlessly fucking scrolling and trying to decide what to watch, or just watching the same fucking bullshit that I've seen 100 times. So, you know, this year started off, as I've talked about, Banshee, which was fucking incredible. And from there, I segued into what was a show on Prime called The Patriot that has 2 seasons. And I watched it for – it had a strong first episode and a really good premise, a really strong first episode. And then it kind of petered out, and I made it through 4 before I threw in the towel. And then I switched over to The Wire, which, you know, for all of the talk everywhere is that The Wire was like the second greatest HBO show ever next to The Sopranos, et cetera, et cetera. So the first season of The Wire, and I'll make this super fast, I promise, but the first season of The Wire, I was mixed on. I didn't get what all the fucking hype was about, this being like the greatest TV show ever. It just played out to me like a 12 episode Law and Order story that gets, this is like Law and Order gets wrapped up in one episode, and this was like a Law and Order episode that got wrapped up in 12 episodes. I got more into the second season and enjoyed it more, and last night I finished watching the third of the 5 seasons, and I'm sticking with it, but I was so invested in finding out how this final the final episodes of the third season were going to unfold, that since Sunday I have been just consumed with watching the last few episodes of that, so I did not yet get to The Ones Who Live. And now that I have finished the season last night, I'll be watching The Walking Dead this evening.
See, I kind of felt similar with the Wire, and I think part of it had to do with the fact that, like, we were watching it many, many years after, you know, it had actually come out.
Yeah, it just had its 20th anniversary, yeah.
You know, and that and like, at the time, for me, I know it wasn't that old, but it was up there, you know. So, like, even at that point, it was still, maybe it was at the 10-year mark, you know, when I had given it a try. I got through the first season with it. And started the second season and never finished it. Like, and I never went back to it. Like, I think about going back to it every now and again, but it's always like, yeah, okay, maybe. And then I don't. I watch something that, like, I've seen again. Like I always say, like, I'll watch something I've seen 1,000 times.
So, yeah, you know, each season apparently has, like, a different kind of overarching theme. Like, the first season has to do with, like, street level dealing in the projects, and then the storyline is
carrying over. The second season was following the cop more, right?
Second season had to do with the dock workers and the dock unions and how they're tied up in the drug trade and smuggling trade. The third season has to do also, like, it's like the same drug universe, but it's all from, like, how decisions get made through politics in City Hall.
It was always from a different perspective is what it felt like. Felt like each season was going to be like basically the same story, but just a different viewpoint to that story each time.
Yeah, the first season is like the street-level drug dealers and street-level cops. The second season is the dock workers and the dock workers' unions that unload the big cargo ships. The third season is from the perspective of City Hall and the mayor and how decisions get made because of politics. And I know I haven't watched it yet, but I know that the fourth season has to do with the role of the schools, of like the public school system in all of this. And I'm pretty sure the fifth season has to do with the press and how the press gets involved in all of it. So anyway, I finished the 3 seasons, and tonight I will catch up on The Walking Dead.
All right. Well, I won't tell you what happened that day. So we're good.
All right. So moving on, I know I shared this in our chat, but the Halloween series, the TV series, as I said, is being billed as a creative reset back to the original film. Miramax's Mark Helig says the show itself is on a fast track and a big priority, and they are currently in the process of locking down the creative team. that the foundation of the show is the original film, those characters, as well as characters that have not been focused on in recent film versions. He said this is not going to be spinning out any of the ideas of the more recent film adaptations, but that is the information they've provided about this Halloween TV series. And again, he said it's on the fast track and a big priority. I'm curious because we know that one of the other pillars of horror franchises is also becoming a series, Crystal Lake, Friday the 13th universe, from the guy, I can't think of his name off the top of my head, who is behind Hannibal series. So it'll be curious to see
Brian Fuller.
Who makes it. Yes, Brian Fuller. It will be curious to see who makes it to the small screen first. I'm sure as things get going and
Crystal
production
Lake.
Starts, that we'll have more information to share as it goes along. But that's what's going on in the world of the Halloween Halloween TV series. I apologize.
Very cool. We'll see what happens. I think Crystal Lake's going to be first because Crystal Lake goes into production this summer. So I would imagine it's definitely going to be first and then Halloween eventually. But, you know, it just sounds like they're just going to reboot shit once again with Halloween. Where it's just, you know, I have a feeling it's going to be contemporary, although I would like to see something in the 70s. I just, you know, I don't know. I think it's just going to make a contemporary one where it's just – this is where we're at. This is where Michael was, and good, yeah.
I don't mind that though. You know what I mean? Like, again, why are we going to replay the 70s? Why are we going to try to make this whole thing a period piece? Like, let's try to make something that kind of fits in with today's, you know, notion of what a problematic person would be.
I mean, the only reason I say that I would like to see it take place in the 70s is because of how well they handled it in Halloween Kills. I was like, this is perfect. I want this movie. I don't want the rest. But, of course, we had to do the rest because it's Halloween Kills. But it kind of made me believe that we could go back to the 70s and do something fun, you know, with Michael. You know, even though that was just the same night that it took place in 78. But I enjoyed it. Like, I really did appreciate what they did with that. But, you know, contemporary is probably the way to go. You're probably right.
What do you think, Dean? Where do you want them to take it?
I don't know, man. Like, I just want something of quality that's, like, worth watching. And not even necessarily, you know, even if it's not not that there's room for, like, groundbreaking ideas here. I just want a compelling watch, you know? Like, I just want something to be excited about and to enjoy and, like, not feel conflicted about. I just want it to bring me happiness when I watch it.
Yeah, it's going to be tough because the recent trilogy didn't really make me that happy. But you're right.
No,
I mean,
you know what? But the recent trilogy did bring him some happiness. He found happiness.
Well, yeah.
Of it, and he...
No, of course. No, I totally did. And, you know, I haven't gone back yet to Ends, but I've seen the others several times, and like I just want something enjoyable, man. Like this is it's like comfort food in a way, and you know that's it. Like I just want an enjoyable experience when it happens. Like I don't want to feel conflicted, and I don't want to fucking have to like debate about it. I just want to watch it and be like, oh, I really fucking like this. Thank you guys.
I find
it's interesting.
Sorry, go ahead. What do you got, King?
No, that's what we all want, I think, as horror fans. We want to see something cool. We want to see something fun. We want to be able to thank the people that made it and be like, you know what? That was fucking cool. Thank you. So, but, yeah, that's all I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't disagree with that at all. I do find it fascinating that, like, everybody's feelings notwithstanding, like, you know, meaning you guys, on Halloween Ends, but like I remember, so like the Dean said, like he has not revisited Halloween Ends. I know I have at least like once. I might have put it on to like go to bed one night. Excuse me, see me talking about it makes me sleepy. But what I actually found interesting, what I find interesting about that film is how much my kids seem to like that movie.
You know, and it's like there's something about that particular film. Like, they found something to relate to with Corey. And that is fucking bizarre, because it's like, wait, that was like the last thing that any of us wanted to fucking see. So why is it like the first thing you motherfuckers want to see?
So bizarre. Different strokes for different folks, as they say. But all right, Dean, what else are we talking about?
Speaking of the recent Halloween trilogy, Exorcist Deceiver is being completely redeveloped, so much so that not even at this time does Jason Blum know what it is going to be yet. Even though the first edition of this alleged modern-day Exorcist trilogy did make $137 million on a $30 million budget, but the studio Hope, which outlaid $400 million to make this happen, was anticipating a much, much bigger return on the investment. The second film in the trilogy had an original release date of April 18th, 2025, with David Gordon Green once again directed, but his script and involvement, you know, came to an end when the release date of April 18th was pulled from the schedule. Jason Blum says that, you know, the move has been made, and that the movie is going to be made, but he needs to figure out what it will, what it's going to be. And at this time, he has no idea what that will be yet. So, you know, not in officially in production, no release date. But Blum says that that the Exorcist next movie will be made.
Well, I mean, they fucking dumped $400 million to get the fucking property, so of course they're gonna fucking make another one. No way they're gonna let that fucking go. So it's, I would not like to be Jason Blum right now, because not only that, but Imaginary, which the ghoul you did see, has been getting a lot of fucking negative shit now too, where it's just like, oh, Blumhouse, bad fucking movie. So it's, you know, taking another hit. I don't know if it's bad necessarily, but a lot of people are just saying it was just disappointing. It was just a very lackluster movie. They're like, Megan was better than Imaginary. So I don't know if that's true. Like I said, I still have to see Imaginary, but, you know, it's just, it's not going so well right now for Jason.
I mean, what I would say with Imaginary was just that it's, you know, we enjoyed it. We did not dislike that film. Me, the Ghoul Girl, and Sam all went and saw it. And you know, I don't think any of us walked away thinking it was like the greatest horror movie we've seen in, you know, any short period of time. But, you know, I don't think either any of us also walked away saying, wow, that fucking, like, it was definitely not Exorcist Believer bad. It did just, it felt like decent. You know, it's decent. It's just like we've said about other certain films, you know, Megan included. There's certain just decent entry-level horror movies. You know, this is a PG-13 film. You know, Sam's 14 now. You know, this is the kind of film that, you know, you drop your kids off at, you know, your teenage kids.
Yeah.
And, like, if they have a younger sibling or whatever, like, you can let them go. They can go and see this movie, and it's not going to, you know, you don't have to worry about it being over-sexualized. You don't have to worry about it, you know, having too much gore. There's a couple quick gore shots that happen, but, you know, for the most part, the movie plays out pretty much what you would expect from the trailer. You know, there were no big surprises. Everything kind of went exactly as I expected it to. So, yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily see what the complaints are other than, you know, if there were people trying to push it as, like, you know, the next Megan. I mean, I don't see that, but, like, you know, Megan was kind of was overhyped anyway, you know, that even the special, when they did the fucking unrated nonsense too, you know. I'm sure that the same thing is going to happen with Imaginary. You know, there's going to be a, you know, I'm sure an unrated version, which will give you all of like 90 seconds more film with, you know, extra gore, this scene or that scene. I will say that similar to a Stephen King takes forever to get to his endings. This movie felt like the first two acts were good, and that it could have built up into a really solid third act and finale. But instead, it felt like the finale got messy. Like they were pressed for time. The studio didn't want the movie to be a certain length. So rather than cut out the stuff that built up to it, instead they cut out the ending, which would have had a lot of explanations to some of the earlier things that they kind of dropped. So going from that standpoint, I feel like maybe if the movie had another 10 minutes maybe, certain things might not have felt so forced in the ending. And maybe that's where some of the complaints are coming in, and that people just feel like, you know, maybe that's the problem. But you know what? The movie made money. So I know it was, I think it was like number two or three in the overall box office. So I think whatever kids movie came out this week was the number one film, and then Dune Part Two took the number two slot, and I think Imaginary was number three.
I still have to see
Kung Fu Panda 4. That was number one in the box office this weekend.
Yeah, I still have to see Imaginary. I still plan on it. It might be an at-home viewing, because I know Ghostbusters is coming up and Waiting on the Devil. But then it got me remembering that Night Swim came out back in January. That was another Blumhouse one. That movie was fucking terrible. But that movie just felt like a rushed Night Swim, not Swim Pen. Swim Pen's much better. Swim Pen I recommend. But not Night Swim. Night Swim, it just felt like a rushed episode of Are You Afraid of the Dark? Like, it wasn't very good, but it fucking made bank. Like, the budget was $15 million. It made back $55.5 million. So, but then again, I was surprised for January it breaking in that much. But still,
it's January.
I was surprised by January.
There's nothing in the theater. There's nothing in the theater, and even worse, there's, like, no horror in the theater in January.
Yeah.
You know, so it's the only, like, decent date movie, like, you know, that could really be made at that point, you know. So they were smart with the release. I knew somebody that saw it, and you know, she was a bit of a shit cat about it.
This wasn't good. I mean, it's just like it was a nightmare. Not Nightmare on Elm Street. An Are You Afraid of the Dark episode, just kind of bigger budget. You know, so it wasn't terrible. It also wasn't great. But either way, what else are we talking about, Dean?
So,
yeah,
after all the talk, after all of the mystery, after all of the questions about what was going to happen, it seems that officially Neve Campbell has signed on to return for a seventh edition in the Scream franchise, returning once again to play the role of Sidney Prescott. And in addition to that, after all of the casting drama surrounding Melissa Barrera and Jenna Ortega and all of the directorial issues, in addition to Neve Campbell's return, Scream veteran and OG component, none other than Kevin Williamson, is returning to direct the seventh film. This film is going to be written by Gary Busick, who wrote Scream.
Gary Busick.
from Scream 2022 and Scream 6, along with his writing partner, James Vanderbilt. So,
James Vanderbilt, the Dawson?
You know,
oh,
when
God.
I wrote
and
his name
Gary
down,
Busey?
I knew that the ghoul was going to make a Vanderbeek joke. But Neve Campbell and Kevin Williamson returning to the Scream fold once again.
Cool.
Wow.
We'll see. I don't know. We'll see what happens. I mean, obviously they're going to have to do a reboot again because the two main girls are out. So it's going to be another reset and another movie, and you know,
well,
we can erase what happened
necessarily.
In the last
Not necessarily. They still have to continue their story. You know what I mean? Their story ends with them in New York, and that's that. You know, we're never going to find out about, you know, Melissa Barrera's fucking, you know, daddy issues and whether or not she was going to eventually become a serial killer herself. But and we don't ever have to find out about any more Jenna Ortega stuff in the movie series.
Thank God.
But they could still exist. You know, they were in a totally different location at this point. So, you know, back to Woodbury or wherever they're gonna pick up Neve Campbell and
Woodsboro.
Williamson. Wood, yeah, that's what I meant. Woodsboro.
Woodsbury's Walking
Dead. There you go. We'll see. I'm merging worlds. I'm sure with Williamson coming back, it's gonna all go back to where it started, and hopefully, it's a sign too that this will be the final one. You know, let him end what he began.
Yeah, I hope so. I really do. I really do hope so. And they did say that it was originally going to be a planned trilogy with Barrera and Ortega, but when they both left, those plans were scrapped. So you might be right. They might still exist in this universe, but I think we're going to get a soft reboot. I think we're going to get a reset, you know, where they might just skip over five and six and just go back to four. You know, I don't know. I don't really give a shit at this point.
Yeah, but in order to do that, then you've got to bring Kirby back, and we know that Kirby was involved with the New York incident. They may not, you know, they may just only slightly reference that those things occurred, and that's it, you know, and that's good. I don't think they
the rules are different. We're a franchise now.
That's right.
Sure are. Sure
beautiful
are.
Franchise.
All right, Dean, what else are we talking about?
And then, not that we need to have commentary on this one, but the Crow remake starring Bill Skarsgård gets its trailer tomorrow. So if anyone's looking to that. But then the final item, so timely and so topical, coming from Psycho Gorman director Stephen Kostarski. Kostanski. And actor Daniel
George
Bernhardt, who has worked consistently in low-budget action. He painted in all of the Bloodsport sequels. He had a role in John Wick. He was most recently in Extraction 2, amongst lots of other things. So Kostanski will be directing. Bernhardt will be starring in the upcoming Deathstalker remake.
Nice.
Damn.
You know what, man? Deathstalker. I guarantee you they heard our show last week, and they were like, you know what? It's time to bring this shit back.
The Deathstalker remake will start filming this late April. And allegedly, there's going to be a greater emphasis on the fantasy setting. And in addition to that, there's also going to be a related Deathstalker comic series coming from Vault Comics.
Look at that. All things Deathstalker. Yep. We'll have to go to the theater to see that one for the episode.
Fuck yeah.
Sounds like
a cinema to me.
Oh, that's going to be a synonym for fucking sure, dude. We're bringing it back for Beastmaster. We're bringing it back for Deathstalker. We are. Synonym's back, baby. That's so cool. But before we get into the movie tonight real quick, I wanted to say a fun thing that Fright Rags, my favorite company for horror t-shirts, they are celebrating the 45th anniversary of Dawn of the Dead by releasing a couple hoodies and t-shirts. But the one that got me the most excited is that they are re-releasing a
2004
reproduction
movie?
Back in 78 when the movie got filmed, everybody that worked on the film crew, including Romero himself, got a black and white Dawn of the Dead logo t-shirt where on the back it said, "When there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth, George A. Romero." So Fright Rags reproduced that shirt and they're releasing it as part of their 45th anniversary collection. So I did pick one up. I cannot wait to get it because that t-shirt was always so fucking cool. And part of history. It's not the same one. Obviously, it's a reproduction, but to have that in my collection is going to be just fucking tits. Because even though 2004 is superior to the 79 version, I adore Romero's Dawn of the Dead so much. And to add that to my collection.
I finally admitted it. Live and on the air.
Sure did, because you guys say it anyway, so might as well just say it. Anyway, I'm very excited to see that happen, and I came up to get it shipped the first week of April. But either way,
I couldn't believe you.
We're not
the peer pressure like that.
I know.
Yeah.
I just that's why I did drugs like in high school. I just bent the peer pressure a lot. But anyway, we're not talking about my drug use in high school or Dawn of the Dead. We're talking about Wolf Guy from 1975, directed by Kazuhiko Yamaguchi, or Yamaguchi, whatever. DeMonk Dean, this is your film pick of the week. Why don't you give us a synopsis and what you thought about Wolf Guy?
Wolf Guy, 1975, again, as the King just said, from Kazuhiko Yamaguchi. This one from 1975. Starring Sonny Chiba as some kind of law enforcement official.
He's a reporter.
Who
is, he's a reporter.
I thought he was an officer of some kind. But anyway,
he's a reporter.
He digs into the criminal underground to find out what's going on with mysterious deaths caused by a potential invisible tiger that is, you know, trying to find out about these bloody killings and uncovers a mystery involving a singer and corrupt politicians and blood harvesting and lycanthropic werewolf powers as well. As learning his family heritage and destiny. So, I mean, I guess that's the best way to describe this. And I just want to say, this is one of those I heard about several months back for the first time. I hadn't heard about it previously. And I tried to locate the article or whatever it was that I read that made me be like, oh, man, I have to make this a pick for the show. So much so that in my phone, where I have my movie note, where I make the lists of things I want to watch for the show, next to Wolf Guy in all caps, I wrote the words "this one," meaning like pick this one soon. And I know that this was like a movie apparently that was lost for quite some time and long sought after, and like a much loved cult classic. And I'm curious to see what you guys felt about this, but based on what I had read about it and how I was feeling heading into watch it, I was let down and disappointed, and this did not meet my expectations of it in any way, aside from the fact that the fucking soundtrack was fucking stunningly spectacular.
So
but other than that, I was not super into Wolf Guy.
Okay. So, Ghoul, what'd you think about Wolf Guy? Enraged Lycanthrope.
So, engorged like Lycanthrope. That's how I looked at it. He is the engorged Lycanthrope.
He gets a lot of sex.
Veiny, pulsating, throbbing. That's how I saw this Lycanthrope. I had never heard of this before. So, no idea of this movie's existence. So I guess my feelings overall going into it with zero knowledge of the movie. So I don't know what I am expecting, but you know, I see Enraged Lycanthrope. I know what a lycanthrope is, so I'm assuming that there's going to be a werewolf in the film. I felt let down by the overall product. There were plenty of things to enjoy through the film, though I did find it to feel very much like an American exploitation movie in how it was presented and how the dialogue was put together and especially how the subtitles played out, because there were just times where I felt completely lost. And I would figuring like, oh, okay, maybe my mind wandered a little bit and I just need to rewind real quick. I'll rewatch it, and now I'll understand what's happening. Only to do that and realize, yeah, my mind did wander, but I missed absolutely nothing. I just didn't understand what the fuck was going on. But I did understand that he was a reporter. I did understand that she had syphilis. I did understand that her resentment is what created a invisible demon tiger that was roaming around and murdering all the people that she hated and had problems with. I also understood that he was the last of a wolf tribe with which she was supposed to be imbued with special powers on the 15th night of the lunar cycle, which would be the full moon, which I assumed happened regularly. So I would assume that that just means he gets powered every full moon, just like a werewolf does. And, you know, my problem was I spent this entire film waiting for a transformation that never occurs. And, like, that really, I think, is what ends up disappointing me here, because it was like, wow, I was waiting for this. I was waiting for this. I was waiting for this. This doesn't happen. Why the fuck doesn't it happen? Like, why aren't we getting this transformation? Why aren't we getting a werewolf? Why the fuck are they calling it a lycanthrope if he's not an actual werewolf? So, but I guess lycanthrope could mean wolf person. So,
wolf guy.
Like I said, it feels like an exploitation movie. There was a lot more tits in it than I would have expected for a Japanese film. There was a lot more, you know, lot more gore, you know, even if the blood was fake looking. You know, so for titties and gore, it was enjoyable. You know, for story and any kind of, like, quality of film, not so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, it's a fine exploitation movie from the '70s, especially from Japan, created by Toei. That was the Toho horror division of the company, and it's a great soundtrack. You know, the blood is great, the tits are great. I mean, if you're looking for a werewolf movie, you're come to the wrong movie. You know, they do talk about werewolves a lot, but it's not. It's Sonny Chiba fucking a lot, beating up a lot of people, and there's some blood. You know, and then you get a great, like, 70s disco synth soundtrack. So if that's your vibe, then you're going to like it. If it's not, then you probably will want to watch an actual werewolf movie. Because the whole thing, as we talked about, is about the lunar cycle, which starts at night 3 in the beginning of this movie, where there's a guy running around in a panic saying that he's being attacked by a tiger. But, of course, intrepid reporter Akira Inugami is there trying to smack some sense into this guy, but the guy gets away, runs into an alley where he's slashed to death by an invisible monster. Akira gets to the alley just as the man dies, but he suddenly hears a strange voice and sees a superimposed image of a tiger. His voice then claims that tonight is another night for bloody violence as we sit lit torches being thrown onto a straw hut. The credits, as the ghouls say, play over a village being raided by soldiers, and then we see a little boy being very pissed off about what happened. So if you rewind it, sure. If you don't, you're fine, because it's going to come back.
I have.
Don't worry about it.
This is one of the, but see, this is one of those moments in which, like, I ended up, like, because I was watching this, and Zach had sitting down, like, had sat down in the room, and, you know, like, I didn't realize that we were going to get this character's, like, backstory in the credit. So, like, we were kind of having, like, a light conversation, and, like, I'm realizing, like, as the little boy is, like, staring at the end of it, I'm like, oh, I just, like, missed a bunch of shit, didn't I? And then, like, I went back, rewound it, watched the whole thing, and I was like, actually, I didn't miss shit. Like, they just burnt his village down. Everybody died, and he's just mad about it.
Mm-hmm. And you'll get more later, so it's like, it's fine. But anyway, we cut back to police headquarters where Akira is being questioned because wherever he goes, there's an incident. He's being considered a suspect in the man's death. The autopsy results are in, and it's death by demon because no human could cut up a man like that. Akira is free to go. As he steps outside, the Japanese version of Burt Young shows up, saying that wherever the wolf goes, there's trouble. The man is Arai, a fellow reporter who goes on a ride with Akira, explaining to him that the man that died was named Hanamura and was in a band called The Mobs that split up some time ago. The band was managed by Manabe Pro, and that guy that led Manabe Pro was into girls and drugs. All Akira knows is that Hanamura thought a tiger curse was killing him. It turns out the mob's members were also slashed to death. First was Yoshihara, killed in his own apartment. The second was Nakao, whose car exploded as he was slashed to death. The explosion also killed his girlfriend. The only one left is the band's leader, Hiruma. Following? Me too. Anyway, we then cut to a man, presumably Haruma, tripping down some stairs as he begs a ride for a drink. A ride will get him that drink, and he tells him about this Mickey woman. The man says that Miki Ogata was a young singer. Apparently, he and the band took turns raping her. Akira thinks there's got to be more to the story, right? Apparently, someone in the band, definitely not Haruma, gave her syphilis. Soon after she got hooked on smack but kept on singing, Miki must have been the one to put the tiger hearse on the mobs. Haruma, this is in disbelief because they were just doing what they were told. As Akira tries to get the name of who told them who raped Miki, a group of men show up looking for Haruma. Akira decides to send Haruma off with Harai while he kicks these guys' asses. During the fight, Akira slashes the faces of some of this gang pretty fucking badly. That's our wolf. Akira then gets shot in the arm. He drops to the ground and sees the crescent moon and exclaims, shit, before getting a quick lick of his own blood. You know, frenzy. So Akira runs for his life from the gang as a girl pulls up on a motorcycle and motions for him to get on the back, nearly taking out the gang in the process as she rides away. They head back to her apartment where she comments on Akira's animal instincts and then strips down to her underwear, then licks Akira's blood off of his fingers. They start getting it on, but she says that he isn't human. He asks, what does that make her? Well, sir, she's just a woman that wants to fuck an animal. Go, Akira. It's your birthday. Get some of that pussy.
So I'm sitting here watching this, right? And all that's running through my head is, man, this seriously feels like it would be a wonderful film for them to make a Kung Pao movie with.
Yeah, it would definitely fit that. Like, it just felt like that watching it, especially with all the fucking sound effects that they do with the punching. Yeah, this is fucking Kung Pao. You know, but it's fun in its own way.
It just had me think of that scene where she's like stripping down her clothes and she's like, take me now, chosen one. Oh, wait, no, I don't want you to think badly of me. Oh, wee-oo.
So after Akira has sex, he has to go to a restaurant eating a steak while Arai shows up with Mickey's photo and her resume. Manabe pros who pass Miki around to the members of the band. The orders came from Kenichi Manabe, boss of Manabe Pro. Arai reveals that during the investigations, he was roughed up by the gang from earlier. They're working for Manabe and known as the Sakuta Gang, the most brutal killers around. I guess Akira got bored because he decides to leave while fucking Arai is telling this story. Arai runs after him saying, well, if they're after me, they're after you too. And Akira doesn't give a shit, wishes his friend well, but says, you're not going to be lucky later, so you might as well tell me where I could find Miki. And apparently skipping from one cheap script of another. Yep.
Isn't this also where we get the backstory that she was dating the prime minister's son? She was an up-and-coming singer, and
did I miss that already? I wrote that down.
It just wouldn't have worked because he wanted to match.
Oh no, that's later.
That was later.
I have it in my notes later.
I'm like melding all of the story together. My bad.
Yeah, because after Arai dies, he reads the notes from his notebook, and that's where it is in his notebook.
That's right. You're right. I'm sorry.
I was like, wait a second, that didn't happen yet. Anyway, so they cut to that strip club where Miki is performing a song about a woman's nails being the claws of a tiger. The men get mad that she's not taking off her clothes and begin hitting her with trash that's laying around.
Balls of a
Akira
tiger?
Arrives at the club and in the back room beats up the club's manager before speaking with Miki. She's in need of money for her drug habit, won't do anything and say anything to get the cash.
They always are.
Akira gives her the money and drives her to a big-time casino. She's grabbed by two men or taken to a back room where we see a man waiting for her, and she tells him that Akira has brought her there, and he's waiting outside. She gets thrown on the couch and gives the fix that she's needed. The men then return with Akira, who doesn't seem to be worried, as a cigarette gets lit by the leader of the gang, of the Sakuta gang. One of the members hits him in the back with a baseball bat. He falls to the floor and is told that there's something they want to show him. A door slides open, and the man is standing in an oil barrel, and he's been beaten. Oh, shit, it's Arai. And Haruma's there, too.
Fucked up.
Arai is currently with his feet on a barrel, about to be hung. If Akira keeps messing around, he'll end up just like them. Quickly, Akira starts throwing spare change at the men. I don't know why, but he has it, and he's going to throw it. And then Akira starts kicking their asses until Manabe, the leader of the gang, not Manabe, I did my notes accidentally, it's Manabe, aims a rifle at his back. Haruma begins screaming, and the distraction allows Akira to kill the leader. Slashes appear in Haruma's face as a superimposed tiger appears and kills Haruma. Akira tells the man that it's Mickey's curse. He then fires a rifle, and they run off as Mickey begins singing her tiger song again. Arai's feet slip off the barrel, and he dies from hanging. And after he dies, Akira reads through the notes that Arai had left. And this is where we find out that Mickey met the son of a conservative bigwig named Yoshiyuki Fukinawa 2 years ago, and they fell in love.
Fukinawa.
They were on the verge of marrying, but Yoshiyuki was furious over their relationship, especially since he was on the verge of gaining more political power and needed to raise funds, so he was planning on a marriage of convenience between his son, Junichi, and the daughter of a financial mogul. This is a lot, so stay tuned, folks. Knowing their relationship would be hard to break up, Fukunaga reached out to Kenichi Manabe of Manabe Pro, and the mobs were hired to gang rape Mickey. Once Junichi saw photos of the rape and that Mickey has syphilis, he immediately dumped her, and that's what led Mickey to try to kill himself.
Injection.
So, what a guy, Junichi. You know, my future wife-to-be was gang raped and got syphilis. I'm out of here. I'm going to marry this mogul, his daughter. So, later, Akira watches over Mickey as she sleeps, and he notices on her bedroom mirror she has written "Death to Mobs" in lipstick. She wakes up. Akira offers her a cigarette and offers to help her so she can get her help for her illness and addiction, and should get the money from Manabe Pro. He thinks there's someone else behind Manabe Pro pulling the strings. But she tells him to stop meddling and go home.
Mm-hmm. You know, why would we get, you know, our syphilis taken care of?
You just got to get some of that, some of that medicine.
Just got to get some medicine, got to get that addiction taken care of. But she then says, you wouldn't fuck a drug-addicted girl with syphilis. Nobody helped her when she needed it the most. Then Akira starts immediately kissing her hand and pushing his other hand over her mouth as she's shouting that he'll catch it, but he doesn't care. He attempts to bang the fuck out of her, but she tells him that she wouldn't feel it anyway. If he wants to win her trust, he'll just have to stay there with her and love her. Akira is then like, oh, shit. Then she's like, huh, I'm just joking, okay? And he decides, I'm going to stay.
Chosen one.
Yeah, but I must go. No, you must stay. Yeah. I can just hear the fucking jokes over that. So
yeah,
we then cut back to a black
movie. This would have been a great pick. This really would have been a decent film to try to like do the second movie with. Rather than doing a kung fu flick this time, let's do like a Japanese-style exploitation flick.
It would have been cool. I kind of always hoped that they would do a sequel to Kung Pao because I love that fucking first one. But were they? Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I wish
yeah,
they
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I still kind of hope they did.
They always had it set up for it. They just never happened.
Yeah. But like you said, the fact that they would make it like a Japanese kind of exploitation film, I think is even better. You know, to take one of these like Yakuza mob movies and then make it kind of like Kung Pao. Maybe one day, who knows, you know, Steve Odenkirk might decide to, maybe he'll listen to the podcast tonight, just like we got Deathstalker made. Yeah, he might listen to it and be like, you know what, going back in, another Kung Pao movie. Listen to Talking Terror, they're on it. So we get a black and white flashback from the credits opener, and the dying woman tells the boy that he's the last of the Inugami family, the last wolf. So this is Akira's origin story. On the 15th day of the lunar cycle, when the moon is full, he'll be invincible. Keep in mind, folks, she said on the 15th day of the lunar cycle when the moon is full, he'll become invincible, not become a werewolf. She made that very clear. And then we cut to lunar cycle day 8. Akira has decided to stay with Mickey, as we had said. The following day, Akira pays a visit to Manabe Productions. Akira meets with Manabe and tells him that he has Arai's notes and knows everything, but Manabe denies this. He then explains to Manabe that Mickey's hatred for the mobs caused the tiger curse, which killed them all. That night, a hitman arrives at Mickey's apartment to kill her, but Akira surprise attacks him. Hey, quick chop. The hitman throws a mouse on the floor, which distracts Akira long enough for the hitman to toss a rope over Akira's neck. I love the fact that he just had a mouse to throw. Okay, I'm going to throw this mouse, and it's going to totally freak him out, which it does, because it's long enough for him to put a rope over
him. I assume this had something to do with, like, his wolf instincts. You know, and that's why he went, like, to go after the mouse, like, right off the rip. But it was, like, I don't know. It was just, again, like, random. Like, hey, you said random mouse that I happen to have. Okay.
So, because I actually had to rewind that because I couldn't figure out what the fuck he threw the first time. I'm like, what is that? I was like, oh, it's a mouse. Like, again, that's a great fucking Kung Pao moment. He throws a mouse. Oh, no, my biggest weakness, mice. Some shit like that.
Oh,
make it funnier,
snack.
But oh, you brought a snack? I brought a snack, too. It's called death. Like, something fucking funny like that. So as the hitman begins strangling Akira to death with the rope tied around his neck, the hitman is shot in the back and dies just as three men enter the room along with the woman he banged earlier.
One man leaves.
Three men and a woman enter. If that's how it goes, I don't know. We do get the girl's name at the very end because I just put her as a girl agent, but man, she was fucking smoking hot for the 70s. You know, she just had all the right looks. Her body was looking good.
She was also like a French Japanese actress, so you know what I mean. I don't think she was like she wasn't straight Japanese, but yeah, whatever her whole look was quite exotic and attractive.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, because like I said, definitely you could tell she's not straight Japanese, but there was just something exotic about her that I just felt like, okay, I'm in this for her. So Akira and Mickey are knocked out. Yep, that's me. So Akira and Mickey are knocked out and taken to the Cabinet Intelligence
Agency. Sure, she
agency,
wasn't too young
AKA,
for you?
No, she might. Well, not now. Now she's of age. She's not dead.
She's the perfect
I hope she's
age
not
for the king.
Yep, she's reached that perfect age. But yeah, the Cabinet Intelligence
ripe.
Agency. Yeah, she's ripe and ready for the pushing. The JCIA, the Japanese Cabinet Intelligence. I was like, okay. They never say why there's a J in front of it, but I'm assuming it just means Japanese. But apparently they think Akira, the Wolfman, will be a great asset for them. But the head of the JCIA is more interested in the girl at the moment. Later, we find a man strapped to a bed frame and Mickey walking around in her cell. She's asked to channel her anger at...
It's so fun.
It's so fun. Hey, Mickey. I don't care. I don't give a fuck. This is fun, man. We're talking about fucking wolf guy. She's asked to channel her anger... was that supposed to be Manabe that's on that weird bed frame, or is that just some random prisoner that they found? I could not figure out if that was fucking Manabe.
I think that was Manabe. I'm pretty sure
it
was.
I couldn't tell. It might have been, it might not have been, because Manabe had kind of like a weird Japanese Elvis thing going on when we saw him, kind of like almost like a Jim Jones look. But I don't know, because they never really explain like who that guy is, but... As he's tied to this weird bed frame, his chest is ripped open, scanner style, and the leader of the JCIA seems happy with the result. We then see footage of a politician dying from the tiger's curse as Akira watches from his cell. One of the agents asks if Akira will help them out, just as Mickey says he's the only one that can free Mickey, and that's not happening. So if I do this, you're going to free Mickey. And they're like, what? You fucking idiot. She's like the perfect robot. Why would we ever free her? Like, that's never going to happen. Like, you might as well just join up with us, man. Even though they don't really know what he's capable of, they just know that, you know, he's gonna do it, but he's not. He's a cure.
Well, they know that he's part of the wolf tribe, so they, you know, they know that he's special.
They know he's special, but they don't know what he can do. So they got to find out, and I guess that's why they're doing this. So... we cut to Akira now in an operating room where he's being cut open and examined, I guess. I think it's an experiment to test his pain threshold. They just want to see, I guess, how much he can take. Maybe. I don't know. They kind of don't really explain very much. They just explain that if he accepts their offer, he'll be handsomely rewarded. But Akira isn't going for it. So we get these weird transitional shots of, like, Technicolor of his, like, organs being cut and played with. And then we see another man brought into the room.
I was guessing this had to do with their censorship issues, right? Like, this was too far for them to show him, like, being opened up, like, in real time and, like, real color.
I guess, because, you know, like we know with their porn, they have to, you know, kind of blur out the penis when they make porn. So I guess that's kind of the same way with their violence.
Yeah, I think, like, you know.
But do we know that? Do they have to do that, though?
I believe so.
For porn, yes.
The whole idea is, like, the slashing, right?
I know for porn.
Remember, we saw the slashes, and we saw blood, but we never actually see anything really ripped open. It's just like there's like a cut on the shirt. There's blood all over the area. I think for them though, like for them to like, I think it would have probably been considered like penetration, for them to have like really had him opened up that way and showing it. But I don't know if there's been limitations of technology as well, you know, like just not they didn't have a Savini there.
I'll kind of look into that and see if there were any kind of stipulations. I know the pornography thing, but I don't know if that has ever applied to their horror films because, you know, not this one, but they've had some pretty wicked fucking shit come out historically. So,
well, I mean, yeah, Man Behind the Sun being a great example of twisted shit they've come out with. But so another man is brought into the room on a gurney where Akira's blood is being transferred to the man. As we cut the lunar cycle of day 15, this is the final day. This is when he's going to turn into a wolf, guys. This is going to be like the greatest effect of the movie, watching him transform. In his cell, Akira manages to close the open wound on his stomach with his mind powers. That's telekinesis, Kyle. No, it's Tenacious D, sorry. He then bends the bars of his cell and escapes. He fights a room full of guards, but the room fills with a deadly gas until the motorcycle girl from earlier enters with a gas mask and saves Akira. During the escape, the girl who we find out is called Katie gets shot and killed, but not before she says she loves him. Every fucking woman in this movie fucking loves him. I was like,
it's
Akira.
It's his pheromone.
You know, it has to be.
I think it's his wolf pheromone, you know what I mean? Like, he's just, it's almost like Austin Danger powers.
And his mojo.
Mojo,
in
a little of that scent.
Yeah, I just like, you know, she's like, I love you, and he's like, yeah, cool, baby, gotta go. You know, as he hit the you know, fucking soundtrack, which is so good in this fucking movie, as we talked about. But anyway, Akira soon has to fight the man who's got his blood from earlier. This guy looks kind of like a wolf, but that's also because he's half human, half wolf now, not full wolf like Akira, and he soon dies from blood poisoning. Sometime later, Akira updates us because now he's become like Bruce Banner from the Incredible Hulk TV series, where he has to basically thumb his way across the country. And he says that more people have died, and sooner or later, Mickey would probably die from her own curse. All he wants to do is escape the world of humans. He then sees an abandoned building where he can live out his days, but he soon gets attacked by a group of men. They'll know they'll get a lot of money from him. But Akira soon attempts an escape, but gets caught in a trap. He's later freed by the super hot Taka. Another fucking smoking hot girl in this movie.
Taka.
You know, of age now. Not age back then, but she just, like, immediately Taka helped him escape.
I didn't consider it Taka today, to be honest with you, man. I was pretty fucking pissed off. People really need to learn to curb their fucking dogs. I'm at a fucking job today, and I'm wrapping up my hose at the end of the fucking job. And, you know, like, because the hose is filled with a boiler job. So, you know, like, I gotta drain the hose of the water that's in there, and so it doesn't make a mess in my truck. And then normally also, so, you know, because I'm working on heaters, it's the wintertime, it's cold. If the fucking water freezes inside of the hose, I can't use the hose until it thaws out. That can be problematic at times. So I fucking, you know, when I go to drain the damn thing, I always, like, you know, I'll stretch it out on the sidewalk or whatever it is and fucking, you know, be good to go. Well, I'm fucking pulling it up, and I'm fucking rolling it, and I'm pulling it, and I'm rolling it. And all of a sudden, I'm like, what the fuck was that? Because, you know, like, I get this fucking utter whiff of fucking shit, and I look at my fucking hand. There's dog shit all over my hand because some asshole had their fucking dog, like, shit on this guy's lawn, and they didn't bother fucking, you know, cleaning their own fucking dog shit up. Now, this guy doesn't have a dog, so I know it ain't the customer's fucking fault. You know what I mean? It's just some asshole neighbor of his, or who I think is this old fucking man who happened to be walking by as I was writing up the ticket, and he made sure to, like, go to the other side of the street with his little fucking Yorkie poo-poo pup. And I'm like, you know, motherfucker, you're giving me all kinds of eye fucking right now, and, like, I want to hit you with my fucking truck.
Because you know it's him. It's totally that fucking guy. He's like, shit, he found me out.
You know, I've spent, like, every which way fucking but south to fucking clean my hand. Like, I immediately, like, started fucking, I got the antiseptic wipes. I'm fucking dousing my hand in fucking, you know, antibacterial gel, fucking paper towels. I get back to the shop. We've got, like, this UV shit with our fucking soap dispenser. Like, I'm fucking doing everything in my power, man. And yet fucking, you know, I took a shower when I got home using the fucking antibacterial soap. And no matter what, you know, when I put my fucking hand in front of my dog, for some reason, he loves the fucking smell of that hand right now. And I'm like, man, this just goes to show you how fucking shit like this, is, it gets on us and it stays on us and it's fucking gross.
See, now all I can think about is that scene, that fucking scene in Ace Ventura after he fucks Einhorn and realizes that she's Finkel. Then you just see him burn his fucking clothes in the fucking trash can and jump in the shower and start crying. Just in the fetal position in the shower crying. I can see that. Just looking at your hand.
Too many shit
crying.
Stories in my life. I have way too many shit stories.
I have a few. I have plenty. You know, I don't like it. You know, it's too much. You know, whether it happens to me or somebody else, it's just the worst. Because I deal with clients that don't know how to control their bowels too much, so I have to deal with that almost a constant basis, and it's always fun because they're just standing there and it's just coming down, and they're like, "I don't know what happened." Yes, you do. God damn it! Let's go
yes,
clean up.
Yes, you do, Maddie G. Yes, you do.
Stop pooping your fucking pants. Stop shouting. Stop shouting, MAGA, while you shit your pants. I know what you're doing.
Oh, damn. Shots fired.
But anyway, well, plenty of shots have been fired, believe me. With Taka, not Taka, Taka helps the escape
Taka,
of Akira. Akira gets shot in the leg during the escape. A man grabs Taka and threatens to kill her, but Akira gets the upper hand, shooting the man and falls to his death. Taka later tells him that she's from the same village as Akira. Her mother knew the kindness of the Inugami, and her mother named Taka after Akira's mother. She was told about Akira before her mother died, and now she's finally met him. So she immediately fucking strips and gets naked and offers to give him some sweet relief so he can get some sleep.
Yeah,
she's so good fucking considerate.
This is where it gets a little weird.
You know, you're my mom. You're giving birth to me.
Yep. I'm fucking my mom.
I'm bored. I'm feeding off of you and fucking you at the same time. Like,
especially when you're sucking them nips. When he was sucking on them nipples, I was like, oh, here we go.
That Asian girl's really have those fucking sensitive feet. Nips, man. What can we say?
Mm-hmm. But after they have sex, the hillside begins to explode, and I was like, is this supposed to represent fucking coming? I don't know. Like, as soon as the hillside explodes, I was like, is this like fucking one of those comedy movies where it's like, oh, he's coming? So we're going to show the hillside exploding. No, it's actually because Taka and Akira are being hunted again. Taka is injured and given a rifle to hold on to, but Akira is going to take a fight to these soldiers that have shown up. Akira gets shot several times, but it just makes him fucking angry. He grabs a gun and starts killing the soldiers, eventually killing them all. As Taka and Akira embrace, she sees all the bullet holes, and she's like, are you okay? He's like, hell yeah. But this embrace doesn't last long because the Jeep pulls up with two agents inside, and Mickey revealed to be in the back. The agent then tells Mickey that Akira abandoned her and she must kill him with her hatred because he no longer loves her. Mickey says that she's going to kill him because she hates Akira now. The agents and Mickey suddenly vanish as a superimposed tiger appears, but when the agents and Mickey reappear, Mickey's chest is slashed open. Taka shoots a rifle in the air for some reason and immediately dies. Akira picks up her body and rests it against a rock as the agents drive away. Akira's not letting them get away without a chase, so he runs after them, diving to the back of the Jeep. He manages to kill one of the agents before attacking the driver, who falls off a cliff in his Jeep. The Jeep explodes. You think that's the end, but it's not, because Akira picks up Taka's body, throws it over his shoulder, and throws away his rifle as we hit a freeze frame. The end. You know, fucking
other. Yeah, you know, my initial thought was that her love for him outweighed her hatred, and I thought maybe she destroyed herself in like the ultimate like twist of what the government wanted versus like what they would get. Like, she wouldn't be used as a weapon to destroy the one man that like gave her sympathy and love. But no. Taka just shot her and died in the process.
It was just so weird when you see Mickey dying, because they don't really kind of explain what she did. I guess she centered the anger on herself, but then for some reason Taka just shoots off that rifle in the air. Like, it's affecting her at the same time.
No, Mickey didn't kill herself. Mickey killed Taka.
Okay.
Taka shot Mickey. She shot her.
Is that what happened?
That's what it
okay.
is.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. She ended up, I thought the same thing at first. I was like, oh, did she,
yeah.
like, turn her power on herself and kill herself? But then, if you look, it's a bullet hole in Mickey.
Yeah, see, I thought it was slash marks. And I was like, shit.
She was so fine. No, Taka had the slash marks. Mickey had a bullet hole.
Yeah, I completely missed that because I thought Mickey started dying and then she raised that rifle in the air and shot it. So I'm like, oh, she's getting killed too. So it's like a 2-for-1 special where, you know, Taka, you know, is killed and Mickey is killed too. But I don't know. There's two fucking women that loved Akira so much that they died for him. And then, of course, that freeze frame where he throws the rifle off the cliffside. I love 70s movies because they always used to think that the freeze frame was the best way to end a movie. Sometimes. Sometimes, sure. You know, sometimes it's really
always
effective.
Creepy. It always creeped me out, especially whenever they do that, like, heavy saturation to the screen. It just reminds me of things like Sleepaway Camp and shit like that, where, again, like, I found that to just be very, very, it was like the introduction to Tales from the Dark Side. That did that shit,
oh,
too.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, it would do that saturation screen, and it was just like, I don't know, there was just something about it that the distortion of color made me feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Tales from the Dark Side, the fucking theme song in and of itself was fucking terrifying. I remember being a kid, like, getting ready for Tales from the Dark Side, and that fucking theme song went in. I'm like, oh, man, nope, I'm going to walk out of the room real quick.
Scaredy.
Back in, you know, 30
scared,
seconds.
Frightened.
Yeah, I mean,
well, I
love the show, but that fucking theme song was terrifying.
It was like they had like a lake with like a forest by it, and the shit would like
yep.
turn into that like weird saturated fucking like, you know, like shot. And yeah,
mm-hmm.
It was an odd thing. I don't know what it, again, it very well might have stemmed from Sleepaway Camp to begin with, but I'm going to guess
maybe
to have used it. It must be, I'm saying for myself, it might have, like, started with Sleepaway Camp.
Oh, okay, I see what you mean. Yeah.
I'm guessing, you know, it must be something that people find uncomfortable or else they wouldn't use it. You know, they obviously used it for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, I think Sleepaway Camp is the best example of how to use a freeze frame and to make it work, you know, to your benefit. You know, especially being such a shocking ending in and of itself. You know, I know Wes Craven used it a couple times in his early career, like with Last House on the Left and The Hills of Eyes, to a lesser effect, because it's kind of just kind of showing you the devastation, you know, of what just happened and kind of just where are they going to go with it now? You know, like after the parents kill mm-hmm. Krug and gang and you have that freeze frame on the father, you know, after, you know, he's killed Krug. And it's kind of effective because it's just like, where do you go from here? You know, now the parents have begun killers, so...
Where do we go now?
Well, we'll just come out with Last House on the Left, the remake, where we put Krug's head in the microwave. That works for some reason with the door open. Still
without
can't figure that one out.
Closing it. Without, oh, pretty sure it doesn't even work like that anyway, but, so.
It was the worst idea to kind of remake that movie to begin with, because the original is so fucking dirty and disgusting and grimy. I don't know why you would want to go back and remake it, and they tried to, but you can never get back what that first movie was. Like, you can't recreate how fucking dirty, you know, that first one was. Like, it was close to, like, a porno snuff film. You can't.
Yeah.
You know, you could try.
We've obviously discussed that. We talked about it when we covered mm-hmm. the movie. You know, it's, it's just, it's one of the genres that, like, you know, like, I know they even tried to, like, bring back, like, I Spit on Your Grave. And like
they did,
yes.
And like,
they made several entries
in that.
That
they're trying mm-hmm. to like get the whole girl power thing, and you know, women's fucking, you know, getting their shit and kicking ass and all that. But you know, like, I feel like if there's any genre, definitely does not need a reboot, does not need to come back. You know, it's the rape genre, like rape cinema can fucking stay in the 70s. Where it fucking, you know, was not necessarily, like, fucking frowned upon. You know, these days, it just doesn't come off correctly. You know, it's just not done right. You know, like, and today, like, you know, 50 Shades of Grey is, like, kind of where that whole thing goes, you know, like I've spoken about before, the whole CNC thing, you know, like I'm totally into it, but like, I can't see it being an effective horror movie because it just, we live in the world of the Me Too movement and it's just, it doesn't work.
No, I mean, I was talking about that with somebody the other day, like rape revenge movies and how you can't really do them nowadays because we're not really in that culture anymore. Like, we're kind of beyond that. That was more of, like, you said, a 70s thing. Like, I could never imagine a remake of Thriller, A Cruel Picture, a.k.a. They Call Her One Eye, which was the basis for Daryl Hannah's character in Kill Bill. That movie's fucking cruel. Like, it says it in the title. It's cruel. It's mean. It's disgusting. I couldn't imagine somebody saying, I want to remake that movie, and I'm going to give you a $50 million budget. No, you can't. No. It's an exploitation movie from the 70s for a reason. You know, it's because we don't do that anymore. Like, you know, we're a different society where, like you had said, well, I think it was a little bit more accepted back then because, you know, they were more open to it back then. I mean, it was a different time. You know, we're not in that period anymore.
No, unfortunately. But, you know, I'm not even necessarily saying it like it's a good thing. It's just,
right.
Unfortunately, it's just how it was at that time, you know.
I think all horror has to push boundaries. Like, I think all horror should be pushing boundaries. You know, it should always be pushing the envelope, you know, and it should always kind of be on that verge, on that brim, you know. I hate it when horror movies get too safe, and that's why I don't like PG-13 rated horror movies too much, because I feel like they don't want to push the envelope enough. And I think with horror, that's where you're allowed to fucking open it up. You know, that's the genre where you can get away with this.
I definitely think there's a place for PG-13 horror, because again, you got, you know, we look at things like Poltergeist, right? And that was a PG movie. And like that, you know, obviously in this day and age, that would be rated PG-13. Not
for sure.
PG. But, you know, like, I think that, I think those are, we need entry-level films in the genre that are not childish. You know, we don't need a child movie. We need something that's kind of in the in-between there, you know? Like, maybe we didn't have that necessarily growing up because, you know, we had differences in the time and everything. But being that opportunity is there now, like, I don't know if I would necessarily be like, hey, my 6 or 7-year-old kid is going to watch Sleepaway Camp. You know, like, I was like seven or eight when I saw Sleepaway Camp.
That one's like a rite of passage,
mind.
Man.
It is a rite of passage, Dean. You're right.
For us.
We're a different generation. You know, like, we're a different generation from what's there now. And I don't want to say that I completely despise current day PG-13 movies. I don't. You know, there's a couple that I've actually enjoyed, but I think they have to push the envelope in a different way than you would with a rated R horror movie. I think there's a way to do it where it's safe, but also not so safe, where it's just completely kind of sanitized, where it's like, this is clearly a PG-13 rated horror movie. Like, you know, there's obviously not going to be nudity. There's really not going to be any bad language, but you could still make it scary. You could still kind of push it to a certain degree to kind of make it entry level for people of that age, but also not where it's just, you're seeing buckets of blood or tits or anything like that. Like, there's a way to do it, you know, and I think they just have to figure that out.
Show me tits.
But I mean, that's us. Like you said, I was 7 when I saw fucking RoboCop for the first time. So, you know, I'm a different breed.
Well, I mean, you say show me tits. You know what I mean? Like that I find funny. Like, you know, like I get like graphic nudity, like vagina, cock, shit like that. But like breasts.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, because you look on YouTube, and like, I shit you not, man. There's like a guy right now on YouTube who's getting away with like showing things like his asshole being bleached, you know. It gets, and I mean, it is as graphic as fucking anything.
Could they call it medical?
Man. Because basically they're saying, well, this is educational.
Yep.
You know, I'm showing you how to do it. But like, his videos start off with like a close up of his fucking asshole. It's like, what the fuck is this?
Just gaping it with his asshole.
He's making that He's making
winking.
That shit wink. It's like, what the... Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Fucking winking.
Oh. Oh, my God. But, I think there's a way to do it. You know, whether you're on YouTube making educational horror movies or whether you're doing PG-13, I think there's a way to do it. You know, I don't know if I want to look at some guy's brown eye and be like, I'm learning. I don't know.
loves education.
Yeah, I don't know. My education stopped after high school, so I'm good. I don't need to know anymore. But as we close out the episode, thank you again, Dean, for your pick of the week, Wolf Guy. Next week, since it's my film pick, I brought this up, I think it was last week, where we were talking about Late Night with the Devil and how it reminded me of a movie from 1992 called Ghost Watch. Because back in 1992, in Halloween, in England, they broadcast this program called Ghost Watch on BBC, and it became the War of the Worlds for the UK. They believed this shit was real, and this was a documentary, and this shit was actually happening. It's been incredibly hard to find, but Shudder actually just uploaded it to their site. So I saw it. I was like, you know what? I just brought that up last week. I want to talk about Ghost Watch next week on the show. So kind of like precursor Blair Witch Project, but in the UK, they believed it was real, and some believe it to this day to be real, even though it's
Ghost
clearly.
Watch.
But
1992, Ghost directed Watch. By Leslie Manning, adding it
That's
to my Shudder list as we speak.
Wow, dude.
So, yeah, that'll be what we talk about next week. I think you guys are going to have fun with it. It's a fun one. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, is this real or is it not? It's clearly not, but the fact that
Rest
there's people in the UK that still believe it's in this name.
In a few days from now, I'm going to ask you what movie we're covering this week.
Oh, I know. You'll ask me on Tuesday, like you always do.
I'm
glad to tell you.
So irresponsible, can't pay attention.
Just like when it's his own pick, and he's like, what's my pick again? Oh,
yeah, that's
so
right.
Adorable.
That's right, because I won't add it to my list right off the bat. I still prefer to stay an irresponsible man-child.
That's okay. I will keep the responsibility and the onus on me for reminding everybody what their picks are. That's fine. I enjoy it.
Keep your
onus? I do.
I'm glad. Thank you for keeping
Has any of us ever had to ask, has any of us historically, has anyone of us ever had to ask what the movie is on a week when it was your pick?
I did.
Yeah. Ghoul has. Yeah, Ghoul did also.
I completely forgot.
For what his pick was?
For fucking Beaststalker.
You forgot what you picked.
Totally.
He forgot Deathstalker. Yeah, he forgot Deathstalker too. Didn't remember. And I had to remind him. And I was like, really, dude? He's sorry. So, yeah, it happened. It happened. But, no, I will always remind you guys what the film pick is. Even if you don't remember your own, I always remember because I usually watch the movies either on Sunday or Monday.
I was born blind.
I'm the only one. I'm the only one that's made a film pick of a film pick that I had already made that we watched, right? I was the only one that's done that.
Yes. You're the only one that's done that, you know, but, you know, I remember the one time you wanted to pick Microwave Massacre and we're like, dude, that was your pick from like a year ago. And you're like, oh shit, hold on.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Quick. Yep. So it has happened.
Exactly what happened.
That's
okay.
Why I always
week,
go on the,
if I remember right, there was a week recently where I was like, oh hey, can we do this movie? And you guys were like, yeah, we did that like a year ago. So.
Yep. We covered it. all right. But anyway, so yeah, next week we'll be talking about Ghost Watch from 1992. If you guys want to watch it at home, it's available on Shudder. Check it out. We'll talk about it next week. Thank you so much for joining us on today's episode. Dean, why don't you go ahead and sign yourself out?
Oh, I'm so excited to sign myself out. But I'm even more excited to see that we've now made it 2 weeks in a row, King, where you are appropriately prepared to sign yourself out.
Bam, bam, bam. Check me out. Just took half an edible about a half hour ago, and I'm still ready to go, baby. I won't be in a few minutes, but right now, I'm good. So, I'm proud of myself. No more full ones. Only halves. So, all right. Ghoul, why don't you go ahead and sign yourself off?
Stay scared, everybody. Stay scared. And watch out for wolf guys and syphilis. Okay, so, you know, just
yeah,
a quick PSA.
Definitely syphilis. I mean, you can just go get a shot, get it cleared right up. But, yeah, watch out for the syphilis.
Yeah, because you know you're never going to get it from
fucking
diseases
are nothing to joke about. You know, they're itchy. They're bad. You know, you can create the next COVID if you're not careful. So rather than that, practice protected sex with partners that you don't know, or at least make sure that you spray rubbing alcohol all over your junk if you're going to do it that way.
dude.
Hey, back in my day when I was when
cool,
I was calling up hookers, that's what I used to do.
Practice
always had Mr.
Cool says, and not what he does.
Nope. Always
oh,
wear condoms whenever I hooked up with a hooker back in the day. But with a couple seconds to go, I just wanted to say, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Wolf Guy. Next week, we're talking about Ghostwatch. Stay tuned for that. Hail Satan. Hail yourselves. Hail Odorous. Keep America strong. Watch horror movies. And remember, guys, don't catch syphilis. Wrap it up. We'll see you back here next week, folks.